You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to episode 11 of the City of Man podcast, where two evangelical political theorists, a progressive and a conservative, talk about the politics of the day. I am the progressive. I'm Edward Song, an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. And with me, as always, is Coyle Neal, assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. And speaking of the politics of the day, we are recording the day after the Republican convention has ended. And so we thought we would put out a quick episode to try to offer our reflections on the nomination of Donald Trump as the official presidential nominee of the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln. Coyle, you deserve a medal or something like that, as you watch just about every televised hour of the Republican convention over the last 4 days. How are your eyes, and how is the condition of your soul this morning?
Well, my soul's fine because I'm not in charge of that. But my eyes could use a good scrubbing. That's for sure. It was interesting. I have never watched a full convention sort of start to finish before. Mm-hmm. And I should say I didn't watch all of this one. I missed like 20 minutes Monday night when I clicked the wrong link on YouTube and ended up watching the earlier segment that I'd already watched and not realizing I was doing it because they're all kind of the same.
So I thought you were going to say video of the Nazi party in 1930s Germany.
No. That's the last day of the convention. So I would have known that, and black and white versus color, of course. But before we get into the nuts and bolts here, I do have a question for you, Ed, that came up in a different podcast that I was recording that has not been released yet, but I want to ask this so I don't forget it. The two of us on that podcast were both conservatives, so we don't actually know the answer to this question. But you, Ed, as a liberal, what business are you obligated to hate more, Chick-fil-A or Hobby Lobby?
So, I gotta say, people talk about Chick-fil-A with a kind of an adoration that I just do not understand. And I'm not talking about their business values or anything like that. I'm talking about their chicken. I find the chicken very mediocre. And I'm a little bit of a chicken sandwich guy. We were on this long vacation, and I was sort of sampling fried chicken sandwiches up and down New England, and had some really exquisite chicken sandwiches and have strong opinions about chicken sandwiches. And to me, like, the Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich is just like the definition of mediocre. That to me is sort of their unforgivable sin.
There you have it. All right. So back to the convention, I guess we should start with a sort of a quick overview of what went on as much as that's possible. This was a weird convention for many, many reasons. Not least of which is that other than the third and fourth day of the convention, there weren't really keynote speakers. So if you've watched conventions in the past, you know that there will usually be several sort of smaller speeches throughout the session, ending with kind of a big speech. And then there are ways they have parties have of traditionally dividing that up. So usually you would see kind of a senior statesman give a speech on Monday or Tuesday night. If you have a sitting president, if you have a former president that's very popular, you would have that guy take one of those slots. And who wants to come, which if you were paying attention at the Republican convention, the only former presidential candidate who was there was Bob Dole, who is 95 years old today as of our recording. So it's entirely possible he didn't.
I'm not sure if he knew where he was.
Yeah, they may have.
Maybe he thought he was at a Chick-fil-A. And
Right. They took him from Kansas there to Cleveland, telling him they were going to Chick-fil-A. So again, that was not present. And then one of those first 2 days, you will usually see, or you will at least sometimes see, kind of an up and comer being given a time slot, a keynote speech, someone that they want to bring to national attention. That's how we all learned about Barack Obama. Right? I mean, he was given one of those time slots in 2004, I believe, where you know, he's this nobody from Illinois who sort of fell into an open Senate seat that they put in the front of the entire country. 4 years later, much to Hillary's chagrin, he runs for president. There was nothing like either of those things. The first 2 days were basically several short speeches, all dedicated to a sort of common theme that we'll get back to. Day three and four were a little more traditional, but not much. They did have keynote speeches. Ed, you want to briefly hit those?
Oh, yeah. So the theme of day three was Make America First Again. And so I missed a lot of the first 2 days of the convention because I was traveling and tuned back in to day three. There were a bunch of minor speakers before the big headlining event. Well, there were sort of two big headlining events. There was the Ted Cruz speech, which caused quite a stir that
which
I saw.
Was not supposed to headline, right? That was not the point of that originally.
Yes. So he preceded the Trump sons, and the big headlining speech of that day was the speech by Governor Pence, Trump's vice president. The Cruz speech was pretty interesting. I don't know if you have big thoughts about that. I was reading your live Facebook tweeting during the convention. I was really surprised that so I guess the part of the controversy is back at a debate earlier in the year, all of the candidates pledged to support whoever the eventual nominee was.
Yeah, they actually signed the pledge. Like there was a piece of paper they signed.
Yeah. And then Cruz reneged, I guess, by
he originally did endorse Trump.
Yes.
The only one who has consistently refused to keep his word, and we probably should put it that way because it's what you're doing, is Kasich. Kasich mm-hmm. is the one who has sort of held out and said, yeah, when I signed that, I didn't think it would be now. Mm-hmm. Cruz did initially support Trump and then has since backed off, and this was sort of the culmination of that backing off, right? this convention speech.
You know, so that's interesting and not something I followed so much. That support was after all of the attacks on his father and his wife and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, it was very lukewarm support. It was very, mm-hmm. well, I guess he's the nominee now, and I said I would. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's also, you know, a 5-minute press conference is very different from addressing the audience. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
So during his speech, in which he sort of talked very broadly about conservative themes, I guess especially the theme of liberty, which is maybe something that we could talk about later on, but sort of talking a lot very generally about conservative values and the importance of liberties. And then he got to the end and he said, vote your conscience. It's important to support candidates up and down the ticket. The New York delegation started booing. There was a lot of booing. And I'm shocked that they gave him a slot. I have no idea why they gave him a slot. And so, I mean, to me, the question...
According to Republican rules, he has a right to a slot.
Oh, is that right?
He actually could have taken a longer slot if he'd wanted to. But by being the runner-up and by winning as many votes as he did and by having as many states supporting him as he did, uh-huh. he automatically gets a spot on the stage.
Uh-huh. And so the Trump people or the RNC people had no control about the spot itself or what he was going to say.
Right. So I don't know that it had to have been that spot. You know, they could have put him, I suppose, some other night. I don't know what the specifics of the rule are, but he could not be denied a slot without changing the rules, mm-hmm. which, you know, famously they didn't do.
Yeah. So it's interesting to me in some ways. Like, and so there's a controversy about whether Ted Cruz is a weasel because he reneged on his commitment, whether Ted Cruz is super principled, you know, whether he's just Machiavellian and all he's trying to do is to start his campaign for 2020, I guess. But then there's also sort of the debate about whether the RNC or the Trump people were dumb for giving him this slot. And, you know, one thing that's running through the you didn't talk about the Melania Trump speech back on, was that Tuesday?
So, yeah, that was Monday night.
Oh, Monday night.
Yeah, so Melania Trump gave a speech that it was fine. I mean, I, you know, listening to it, I was like, oh, you know, whatever. This is a standard potential first lady speech. But then afterwards, people started noticing certain similarities to Michelle Obama's speech back in 2008. And sure enough, without question, significant portions of her speech were plagiarized.
Yeah. Some people were trying to argue that the words and the themes that she was talking about were hardly unique and particular and were general. And that's certainly true. But I think it's definitely the case that if you or I got that passage in a paper, we would count that as plagiarism. So one other sort of theme that comes up is just the extent to which the convention was run well. And it just seemed like there were these little hiccups that really shouldn't happen in a well-run convention. Like, if you are suspicious that Ted Cruz isn't going to do what he said he was going to do, then you bury him and put him in a – I mean, so he's entitled to a spot. Is he entitled to a prime time spot?
That I don't know. I mean, the session itself is in prime time. I mean, other than Monday, all of the sessions were evening sessions. So I don't know that you could really get around that.
You could bury him and make him the very first speaker. Very first speaker on the very first day.
Well, and what makes it interesting, so this is from the Conservative Review site, so, you know, take this for what it's worth, but they argued that the Trump campaign had seen and pre-approved his speech, which is almost certainly true. There's certainly vetting of those sorts of things that go on.
Yeah.
But they also suggested that the Trump campaign approved the speech and then encourage their supporters in the crowd to actively boo Ted Cruz if he wouldn't sort of go off speech and endorse Donald Trump.
In the speech they approved, he said something to the effect of, "I endorse Donald Trump."
No. So the speech that was approved was the speech he gave.
Oh.
And then that's for what it's worth. Right. So the idea being that Trump was sort of taking this as a chance to get petty revenge and make Cruz look bad. And in fact, at some point, a campaign manager for the Trump campaign was asked, you know, did you tell your people in the crowd to start booing Ted Cruz if he wouldn't endorse Trump? And his answer was basically, "I can't answer that." Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe there's something to it. Maybe it's just a sensational story. Either way, I think if I'm Ted Cruz, I'm just really regretting signing that pledge. That's sort of the big takeaway, is I should not have done that, because had he not, no one would care. He still would have had a spot. He still could have gone up and said whatever he wanted. There wouldn't have been the same pressure.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of why I try to stay away from the business of making really sweeping blanket pledges in life.
Right.
They're just dumb, because you never know what's going to happen going into the future. I'll talk about the vice presidential speech in a second. But is there any kind of emerging consensus about whether Cruz hurt or helped himself?
Yeah, there isn't, in part because the people who don't like Trump think that he helped himself and the people who do think he hurt himself. Mm-hmm. So it's exactly the fault lines we'd expect to see. And you've just got to remember, the American attention span is about 30 seconds long. So when he kicks off his campaign for 2020, it's going to be a new campaign anyway. People are going to have to be reminded that they ever knew who Ted Cruz was. So I think at this point we can sort of say it's neutral. I don't think it cost him anything not to endorse Ted Cruz, to endorse Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I will say I skipped over these guys. Tuesday, Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan both also spoke, both sort of famously, nationally, noisily anti-Trump, or at least not pro-Trump in any meaningful sense. Both of them sort of nailed the way you're supposed to do that. A very positive, you know, Republicans are going to fix things. Congress is going to take the reins next year. Just put us in and we'll do our job well. Very, very focused on things that they are in favor of, with only sort of a glancing nod to Donald Trump at all.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way you're supposed to do that when you're opposed to the candidate. Cruz went more aggressively blatant in his rejection. I was a little surprised, I guess, on the Cruz night also. Scott Walker also spoke, and he was much more pro-Trump than I had expected. So I had been a Scott Walker fan sort of up until that point. I may still be, I guess, but I question his judgment a little bit more now.
Mm-hmm.
Walker let me down, man. That's a little disappointing.
Mm-hmm. The Trump son spoke later on that evening. I thought that they were well-spoken. And then day three wrapped up with the vice presidential speech. Do you have particular thoughts about Pence's speech?
I mean, the first time I'd ever heard of Pence was him giving in to the bullying over the religious freedom law in Indiana. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't terribly surprised he was picked as a candidate. I mean, he has a history of giving in to bullies. That said, it seems like he's a nice guy. Seems like he's probably an okay governor. Other than, you know, the one time I was paying attention to him, he made a decision I don't like. Based on that speech, if that were, you know, because that's mostly all I know about him, I would say he's fine, other than his endorsement of Trump. So it's kind of that mixed bag of he seems like he has a good head on his shoulders. He seems like he has some background, some qualifications for it. And yet, by thinking Trump will be a good president, that also seems to sort of belie the fact that he's qualified to be vice president. So, yeah, I could.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, he was selected, I think, just because, I mean, aside from that, the religious liberty issue that you just mentioned, it's otherwise. So he served in Congress for a number of years before he became governor of Indiana, was one of the early Tea Party guys, I think.
He was.
And sort of.
And he's sort of like Rubio and Ryan, where, again, from the little I know of the guy, he had earlier been a Tea Partier and then kind of jumped off the Tea Party wagon and moderated a little bit,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is a sign of wisdom. I think that it's one thing to have ideals. That's a good thing. It's another thing to say that if you never, ever, ever compromise, that if you ever compromise, you're inherently bad. Well, that's just unwise.
Yeah. And so the point that I was chasing to is that he sort of has impeccable conservative credentials on all the core issues.
Right.
That one little issue that you mentioned earlier aside. And I think he has a reputation. I have no reason to doubt that, as you say, he's a decent guy. You know, there's that really interesting New York Times article, I don't know, that you saw, in which a Kasich aide.
I did see that.
Did you see that? Which was you know, you had raised the issue, why would anybody choose to be his running mate? And so the article was basically suggesting that Trump's people approached Kasich and said, hey, are you interested in being the vice president? He said, no, of course not. Why are you even approaching me? And they said, well, look, think about it. You're basically going to be president, right? You're basically going to be in charge of all domestic and international issues. And domestic and international issues basically means everything, right?
Right.
And then the person went on to say, Trump sees himself as being the CEO, not the COO. He obviously imagines the vice president as basically doing all the things that a normal president does. And what he, Trump, as president will be doing is, I don't know, laying out a vision and giving speeches. But there's a really remarkable vision of what the vice president's role, and the vice president is basically going to be president.
Is the condition under which I would vote for Trump, right? I mean, I think I've said this on social media before, and I'm pretty sure this is not original to me. I will vote for Trump if he picks an awesome vice president and then like has a stroke or something, right? I mean, that's sort of the condition I've set. So saying that he will not be president actually isn't enough for me because I don't trust him, but I think it was Colbert who said, you know, I don't think Trump should be president, and it looks like Trump agrees with me.
Pence, so just because you don't trust his judgment, and that even if Pence is effectively running everything, you never know when Donald's going to put his finger back in the pot and stir it up and do something crazy.
Well, like I also don't believe Pence would be running everything again, because. Although the Trump campaign has repudiated that statement, so who knows if it was made or not.
Well, of course they will.
Right. So yeah, because whether it comes from the Trump campaign or not, if it doesn't come from the Trump campaign, of course you can't trust it. If it comes from the Trump campaign, you can't trust it. So no, that's not the fact that he does have a seemingly good vice presidential nominee is not a good enough reason for me to vote for him.
Mm-hmm. I think the story, I mean, to me, there isn't any reason why the Kasich people have any reason to sort of lie about that, you know, and that in some ways that totally fits like Donald Trump doesn't really want to be president. He doesn't want to do all of the nitty gritty things that presidents do. He wants to run because he's a megalomaniac. I think he genuinely sort of cares about the direction of the country, however misguided that might be to me, and thinks he can make a difference because he's a megalomaniac. But I have no, you know, I have no reason to think that story isn't true. You know, there was also a story about Ben Carson, who was interviewed and basically said that he had been promised a role in the administration, which is a violation of federal election laws.
Well, right. I mean, there are obviously ways you can promise it without promising it. So I think everyone kind of expects Ben Carson to be the Surgeon General if God forbid, Donald Trump wins the presidency. And and for people listening, if I'm saying, you know, I don't want Donald Trump to be president, you'll be hearing exactly the same thing from me next week. You know, if God forbid Hillary Clinton wins the presidency. Same rhetoric all over again for maybe slightly different reasons, but only slightly different reasons. So Carson, I think people sort of expect to be a Surgeon General. And Christie, I think people kind of expect to have some kind of role, it Supreme Court nominee or Attorney General or something along those lines.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think we're in some ways the list of people who have supported Donald Trump. They expect to be rewarded and they may not be wrong. But with that said, these are all still promises from Donald Trump. So take them for what they're worth.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I sort of bogged us down as we're walking through the 4 days of the convention. Let's chase on to the last day. The theme of the last day was Make America One Again. Obviously, the big event of the night was Trump's speech itself. It was the longest speech in history. That I actually don't think is particularly significant, but I guess it was a full 75 minutes or something like that. And he appeared to more or less stay on his prepared remarks, gave the speech. Do you have thoughts on the speech itself and whether it – so it
– man,
well, so, go, sorry, go ahead.
No. So just I would say that first, other than the Trump speech – Thursday night was just a dull night of nobodies. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was people that no one had ever heard of, which was true of most of the convention for reasons that we'll talk about as well. But that night especially, I think that the biggest name on that stage other than Donald Trump was probably Jerry Falwell Jr. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even then, if you are outside the evangelical circles, you're not going to have heard of Jerry Falwell Jr. and maybe only have sort of a vague memory of his dad. The Trump speech itself, I've gone back and read that and tried to sort of isolate it from everything I know about the guy and read it just on its own terms. Like if I knew nothing else about this Donald Trump guy and had only read this speech, what would I think about it? Mm-hmm. And honestly, what I came away with was this guy's a narcissist, which again, we'll get to that. And he's some kind of weird sort of nationalistic Democrat. So by that, I mean sort of liberal leftist Democrat, but with a streak of nationalism in him. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what I got from the speech.
There's a word for that kind of person, Coyle, and that word is fascist, actually.
Well, hey, you said it first. I've tried to call the left fascist in the past, and you shot me down. So I'll
it's sort of the overt violent nationalism that kind of seals the deal.
Yeah, so noticeably missing from the speech, and again, based on everything that we had heard leading up to that, it is a little shocking that it wasn't there, other than it's Donald Trump. But again, we're trying to filter that out for a minute. No mention of anything even remotely pro-life, right? So for a week, we had been told this is the only one who will do anything to stop the Holocaust of abortion. Mm-hmm. Nothing whatsoever said about that in this, you know, 75-minute-long speech. Mm-hmm. No mention of conservative justices on the Supreme Court. Again, mm-hmm. that is one of the major themes over and over and over from the convention is this guy will nominate good Supreme Court judges. Nothing was said about that. Maybe it's possible the assumption was just that had been said so much he didn't need to say it. But again, that's not generally how acceptance speeches go. No real mention of freedom or liberty. Again, those core things that Ted Cruz was talking about. Mm-hmm. Nothing was really brought up when it comes to that. It was kind of a downer of an acceptance speech. I mean, there was a lot of the world is in disrepair, the world is falling apart, and I'm the only one who can fix it. And while to some extent that's to be expected.
We're going to fix it fast, believe me.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent that's to be expected from the party out of power. Like, that's the kind of speech that you give. But this one was so ham-handed about it, like so sort of in your face with almost nothing redeeming about it. So again, comparing this to previous acceptance speeches, at least the ones that I remember, W's and Mitt Romney's and John McCain's, yeah, there was some, you know, except for John McCain, there was some things are bad, but vote for us and things will get better. But it was usually, you know, vote for us, you know, vote for a conservative, vote for a Republican, vote for, you know, whatever it was that the principles were that they held. With Trump, it was all vote for me, right? No nod to it's the Republican Party that will fix things. No nod to it's conservatism. It's, you know, basic American principles that will fix things. And I'm the one who does that. It was all vote for me. I personally am the incarnation of what's needed to solve the problems of the nation. Maybe every politician secretly thinks that. I don't know, but it is one of those things that you're certainly not supposed to say in your acceptance speech. And of course, it'll just feed the pro-Trump crowd who will say, yeah, that's what every politician thinks. He's just being honest and saying it. What did you think, Ed? What was your response?
Yeah, so the big question that I had hovering in my head was the extent to which he would pivot and moderate. Right. So, the classic thing, right, is that up until the convention, you're trying to shore up your base support. And then after the convention, you're going after the middle. And so you start to moderate. That's the typical rhythms of these things. And so to me, it was the extent to which he would sort of, eschew the sort of, darkness and, finger pointing of the early parts of the divisiveness of the early part of the campaign and pivot to try to reach out to independents and undecided voters. And you certainly saw that a lot through the evening. So one of those nobodies who you weren't very impressed by earlier in the evening was Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley entrepreneur. I guess he founded PayPal, was one of the first investors in Facebook, right? So an extremely prominent technology investor in Silicon Valley.
Is he still the head of PayPal?
I don't know if he's still running.
So
PayPal.
I think he's one of the ones who is like trying to blackmail North Carolina into. I should have looked that up.
Yeah, why don't you look that up, and I'll finish my thought. So Peter Thiel is an avowed libertarian, an avowed contrarian, and a gay man. And the first time that an open gay man has spoken at a Republican convention, I guess. So, you know, that mere fact, I think he was obviously there, and there was a lot of scuttlebutt about, what is Peter Thiel doing there? And there was a line in his speech in which he was basically saying, we've got to ignore these culture wars and sort of fix these more central underlying problems. We can't be distracted by these culture wars. You know, standing on and speaking during a Republican convention in which one of the prominent platforms of the party is to enact policies that are bad for guys like Peter Thiel, at least with regard to his sexual orientation. So there were these symbolic gestures like that. Even during Trump's speech, he made lots of references and was clearly trying to reach out to people beyond disaffected white working class voters. But, you know, but there was still sort of running through the speech. I mean, I think the dominant theme of the speech was this overriding sense of darkness and doom. The world is ending, and I, Donald Trump, because of the strength of my will and my skill as a businessman, am the only person who can rescue it. I mean, he was very explicit about that at one point, right? He was sort of saying at one point, and I don't know if this was an ad-libbed line, but he said, nobody knows the system better than I do. And then he kind of smiled.
And yet I'm like, an outsider.
Yeah. And then he said, and that's the only, and that's why I'm the only person who can fix it. But I mean, to me, it was sort of like the overriding sense of doom and dread. There are all of these awful people who are doing awful things to our country. I'm the only one who can fix it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd agree. Do you think he'll get the Bernie crowd? He claimed he could get them.
That's nonsense.
I mean, if he does, I think he'll certainly win the election.
Yeah, I think that's nonsense.
The Bernie crowd is also angry. I just don't know if they're that angry. So we'll see.
Yeah, and the Bernie crowd, you know, the Bernie crowd cares about free trade and the extent to which free trade deals have hurt your average American worker. You know, that's something that you and I have never talked about in all of the episodes that we've done. I don't know if you have thoughts about that as being, I mean, so that's obviously like one of the central issues of his whole campaign. You know, the Sanders supporters certainly care about that, but like they're going to be turned off by all of the other stuff.
Well, I guess it depends on which way you're asking about it. Cause from my perspective, he was coming out as very anti-free trade.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. That's what I meant.
Okay. Yeah.
We have all these bad trade deals. I'm going to go back. I know how to cut a deal. I'm going to renegotiate all these bad deals, and we're going to get a better deal, and only I can do that.
Which, of course, is problematic because the president cannot just do that, right? You have to have the Senate on board. And it is interesting to see a Republican candidate come out as anti-free trade. Like the mm-hmm. Republican Party tends to be very libertarian when it comes to economics, which is why they worked with Clinton to sign NAFTA in the first place. So NAFTA specifically was mentioned which is, you know, hearkening back to the mid-90s. Perhaps unwise to bring it up because no one remembers it anymore. But that's kind of a standard Republican plank in the platform is free trade.
Sure.
And Donald comes out as radically against it.
Well, I mean, this is one area where the mainstream of both parties is in perfect agreement. Or at least historically, well, since the 90s, let's say, since Bill Clinton anyways. So for the last 25 years has been in perfect agreement.
As being pro free trade.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So in a sense, I am not necessarily pro free trade. So I am somewhat sympathetic to that. I'm just not, it makes me a little nervous to say that because it puts me and Donald Trump sort of in the same room, you know, even if we're not, you know, doing the same thing. It was interesting again, from a political perspective. I think that speech would have felt much more at home at the Democratic convention rather than at the Republican convention, other than some of the immigration stuff. So if you cut the immigration stuff out, it's a Democrat speech, right? It's, or at least it is more of a traditionally liberal speech than a traditionally conservative speech or even a neoconservative speech.
Yeah, it was very populist in some ways, right? Expressing a lot of concern for the working class person who's been left out, and Donald Trump saying, you know, I'm going to fix this. Yeah. And there were certainly parts. I'm going to fix college tuition debt. I'm going to fix that. There were certainly parts that sounded more in place in a Democratic convention, aside from the overwhelming dread and doom and finger pointing.
Right. So if you take out the language about immigration and put in the language of, you know, fundamentalist religion, it's a Democratic speech. And I would imagine it is very similar to the speech that we will hear coming from Hillary next week with that change made, right? With, you know, conservative Republicans, or she may not say explicitly evangelical Christians, but instead of immigrants, they will be the enemy. It'll just be the same thing. I might be wrong. Maybe she'll throw us a curveball, but I will be very surprised if she does.
I doubt that very seriously, but anyways.
You don't think she's going to go populist and talk about the plight of the common man and how those awful Republicans are damaging it, and she's the one who can fix it?
Yeah, I just don't. I mean, I certainly Hillary will express concerns about at least some of the same issues, but I think the tone and the direction and the divisiveness is going to be totally different.
Well, it would be different divides, but I think it'll be the same sort of. Hillary is obviously not interested in reaching out to conservative Republicans, so it's not like she's going to engage with him. So again, it will just be a different group that she is dividing from.
Do you think that the tone and style of both campaigns is equivalent and you're just substituting out the people who are the boogeymen? Or do
no,
you think
because
that
I think Trump is so much more crass. So
yeah.
If not for the crassness, then I would say yes. I would say that maybe more so with Bernie than with Hillary. But I would say, yeah, they're the same campaign with different bad guys.
And do you think that the Clinton campaign demonizes in precisely the same style as the Trump campaign? The only difference is the object of demonization?
Yeah, and I think they're probably slicker at it. There is sort of a facade of decency that Trump is just not concerned with. Although it's hard to compare since there's so little campaigning actually going on with Trump. Like all we can really go on are the speeches he gives because the campaign's not producing commercials. They're not advertising yet. So in terms of
they don't have any money.
Well, they're not the money they have. They're not spending like
the money that they have. They barely have.
Yeah. And it's again, it's one of those things that as a political scientist, the rule of campaigns, the rule of presidential campaigns is whoever spends the most money wins. And I mean, that is a almost 100% sort of across the board rule. Whoever spends the most money in presidential campaigns wins. So everyone's kind of wondering, is this going to be another rule that Donald Trump sort of defies the odds on and makes us have to reexamine all of this stuff? Mm-hmm. Or is this sort of the wall? Is he sort of hit the point where he's not going to get to do that anymore? And now if he doesn't start spending, it's all over for him. So, yeah, I can't compare specifics of advertisements. In terms, though, of speeches that I've seen Hillary give compared to speeches that Donald Trump gives, they're different in the words that are used. One is Hillary is obviously more of a career politician. She is obviously much better at not openly insulting people because of disabilities. But beyond that, they're just the same, looking different directions.
Yeah. So I think this gets to sort of one of the things that I want to talk about a little bit later on, but that's just crazy. I mean, you're sort of talking about this facade of decency. I don't really know what to make about that in some ways, right? And so throughout the whole convention, there were people expressing really sort of radical, demonizing sentiments about Clinton and the Democratic Party. And literally, right? So Ben Carson,
right,
he literally demonized Hillary Clinton, right?
That was apparently off script.
Which means that like he really thinks it's true. And those kinds of voices ran consistently through the campaign. Earlier, there was this an African-American pastor, Mark Burns. He was one of the first African-American pastors. I guess he was in that meeting that Trump had and came out as an early supporter of Trump coming out of that meeting. And he explicitly said that Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party is the enemy.
Right. And again, there are ways that it's acceptable to say that. There are ways that it's a party convention. There are ways you should say that, right? I mean, it is your national party convention. You are obviously not going to spend the whole time talking well of the other party. That's not the point of a party convention. But at the same time, there are conventions in the small C sense that ought to be followed, that Trump and most of sort of the core people around him just aren't interested in following.
Yeah. And so you described Clinton as having this veneer of decency. And I don't know what to make of that. I mean, it's either decency or it's not decency. I mean, even if in some ways she thinks as you and I think that he is dangerous. He's a fascist. I mean, the fact that she's not using inflammatory rhetoric in the same way that the Republicans are, like, is significant. Like, that's really significant because inflammatory language like that only increases the level of divisiveness and encourages violence, both political and actual.
So you're not saying he's – and I wouldn't go so far maybe as to say that he is a fascist, but you're saying that he – is a fascist, not because of the policies that he holds, but because of the way he says it.
Yeah,
I'm
but
saying,
it's,
no, it's his policies, at least as far as we can tell what his policies are.
Well, yeah, so I would say some of the policies are fascist, or sort of fascist sounding. So it's both the language, and again, I think the language is significant, right? Because the language engenders and encourages actions of various different kinds. So when Trump brags that he can shoot people and it's not going to affect his popularity, those aren't just idle words. Like, that matters a lot, and that has real world political effects on things. But then also when you say things like, we're not going to let Muslims into the country. There are a couple things there. I mean, there is the policy thing, and that there are all these people who have perfectly legitimate reasons for being in the United States, whose rights are going to be violated, right? And, like, that's a big deal. Right. But then there's also just the language of demonizing Muslim people in the United States. I read this crazy article about how there was this this Egyptian man who had been in the United States for some 20 years, and he was flying on an American flight, and he got on the plane, and within minutes of getting on the plane, one of the flight attendants said his name and said his name in seat 25A, "I've got my eye on you." And then she repeated that later on in the flight. They kicked him off the flight.
Wow.
That happens, that's one story. That happens all the time, right? And that happens because people are ginned up into kind of this irrational fear and hatred of people who look different from them, you know? So it's the language and the policies. And, you know, Democrats can certainly talk tough about Republicans. And I certainly cringe at a lot of the things that Democrats say. But I think it's not just a question that the form is the same, but the content is different.
So no Democrat would ever consider using the power of the government to fine a Christian florist or baker out of existence.
So again,
I disagree with them in explicit violation of their religious rights.
So again, we've talked about this.
We have.
There's certain things about the Democratic Party that I'm progressive, but I don't necessarily agree with everything that the Democratic Party does. That's one area in which my sympathies are a little bit different, and I worry sometimes about certain things that the Democratic Party does with respect to not giving religious liberties their full attention and moral significance. So I'll say that. With that said, it's important to look at the justification for that, right? They're concerned about ensuring that all people, whether they are gay or transsexual, have the same rights as anybody else, right? That's very different, right? So right now in the state of North Carolina, you can be fired for being gay. That I think is wrong. I'm not exactly sure what you think about that, because sometimes you're coy on that point. But I think that's wrong. You can't not rent to a person because they're a gay person or a transgender person.
But that whole moral logic
is totally different than the moral logic that you get coming out of the mouth of Donald Trump.
Well, again, I aside from Trump, well, no, not aside from Trump. So again, I think the logic you're using there also applies to Trump. Now, I think in both cases, the logic is wrong. Because I think in both cases it is oppressive and it is devoiding people of their rights and so on. But from Trump's perspective, assuming this is actually his perspective and he doesn't just change it, although if you noticed in the speech, he did not say banning all Muslims. He modified it the way he had modified it in Scotland. He said we are keeping people out from countries that breed terrorism, which is a very, very different thing than all Muslims.
Yeah, so that was his attempt to walk back the initial statement,
which he'd done a ways back already. Again, you can't say there's not a legitimate claim behind that. It's we don't want people coming over and shooting up nightclubs or flying airplanes into buildings or so on, which is something that terrorists have done.
Sure.
So there is a legitimate thing that maybe by bad logic turns into this other thing, just as on the Democrat side, hey, here's a legitimate thing that by bad logic turns into this other thing. I'm arguing that they are both sort of using that same bad logic with different enemies in mind.
But so again, to me, it's the policy and the language. So again, I would say that there are people from who are coming from situations that have legitimate reasons to be in the United States, and those kinds of policies of exclusion hurt their interests in ways that are unfair and unjust.
Oh, I don't disagree with that.
Yeah, okay. So that's the policy bit. But then go back to the language of demonization. Like Trump last night spent a lot of time talking about the murder of this one woman at the hands of this illegal Mexican immigrant, right? So look, that's horrible. That's obviously horrible. But we're focusing on the language here. It's like this repeated demonization of the other, right?
Sure.
Of saying those people, right? Those dark-skinned Mexican people who are rapists and thieves and murderers, they're coming over here. It's that language. And you just don't see that kind of language. And we've got to do something about it, right? And so it's those overtones of darkness and violence, of divisiveness, of us against them, those people. We're going to take care of those people that you just don't see on the Democratic side.
And I guess I'll be interesting. We will have this resolved next week, right? I mean, we'll know one way or another. But I think it's there. It's just not so ham-handed. So to take the explicit example from the convention, over and over and over, they chanted, you know, lock her up. Hillary Clinton needs to go to jail. Whether or not she actually does is a different question. The fact is that in the minds of many of the people there, she was guilty of something and worthy of being locked up. Now, do you genuinely think that had someone started a similar chant, say, in 2008 at the Democratic convention about George W. Bush, they wouldn't have done exactly the same thing?
So the lock her up bit, to me, wasn't like the most egregious thing that was sort of done or said.
Oh, and Trump, it's the one that involved everyone.
Yeah. I don't think that would have broken out in the same way. I just don't think it would have. And Trump did not encourage it. And it came out later on in the discussion, at least I was watching the CNN thing, that he had been coached earlier on not to encourage that kind of a thing. So during that moment, he was sort of very presidential and was sort of like tamping down that kind of fear.
Oh, but it was all through the convention. I mean, it was repeatedly every night. It wasn't just while he was giving the speech.
Well, that's kind of my point. You know, so there were certainly lots of progressives out there who were saying horrible things about Bush and Cheney. And I mean, it's one thing to suggest that war crimes were violated, and I have no problem suggesting that there, like people suggesting that there might possibly be issues of criminal prosecution going on. Just as it doesn't bother me that people suggest that Clinton broke the law, though you and I were going at it back and forth on a Facebook feed. And to me, I mean, her actions were irresponsible in the extreme, and it's almost pointless defending her on this point. But to me, it's really clear that her actions weren't illegal. Like, really clear that her actions weren't illegal.
So whether her actions are legal or not, do you think she should be allowed to have security clearance?
Wait, let me just finish this point.
Sure,
and then we'll get to that. And so there were certainly progressives who were saying horrible things about how Bush and Cheney should be killed and things like that. But like that was sort of all on the margins in the progressive sphere. It's like, but like those same issues are not so much on the margins in the Republican sphere. And so I think it's not just a matter of forms the same, content's different. There just is a kind of a demonization, a divisiveness, an aggressiveness, they're beyond the pale. You can't talk to them. They're wholly evil. That I think characterizes the language of that convention that is just different than the language that you're going to get next week.
And again, I'm not necessarily disagreeing that the language is different, but the substance is still going to be there. You are not going to see anyone not saying that, again, traditional conservatives are you know, wholly evil, because they are from the progressive side of things. They are the enemy that needs to be smashed and defeated and overcome. And they just won't say it that way because, again, there is this idea of decorum and dignity that you don't do.
Yeah, and then and your point is like that idea, like that's not significant. And my point is that's really significant. You know, and again, I am not always happy with things that Democratic politicians say, and I do not always agree with the things that Democratic politicians do. But I do think that there's like that decorum that you're talking about. You're sort of like, oh yeah, it's just this thin veneer of decorum. Like that thin veneer of decorum is really, really significant.
Oh no, I agree that it's significant. And again, I think it is the difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. It is sort of the dividing line, and that is important. But I'm also saying that's all it is. That is the difference. So it is important, but yeah. How on earth did we get on?
So Hillary, nobody next week is going to compare Donald Trump, literally compare Donald Trump to Lucifer. That's just not going to happen. And I think, and that's not just because they think that and don't want to say that. It's because they don't think that.
Oh. Yeah, I'm going to go
like
with
literally. So the, I mean, they think he's they think he's dangerous. I think he's dangerous. I think you can that the description of fascist is in a lot of ways an apt description. And I'll like fascist is a political label. It describes a particular kind of politics. I think it fits. But you're just not going to get the same level of they're beyond the pale, the same level of divisiveness, the same kind of anger and rancor. You're just not.
Right. Well, and again, we will know more next week, I think.
We'll know a lot more next week. Maybe we should back out, and I'd be interested in just – there's sort of one – there's a way in which I want to sort of cap off that whole line of thought for me. But we should back out a little bit, and maybe I should give you the chance to sort of offer your overall impressions of the week. And
well,
the themes.
Go ahead and cap off your thought then, and we'll –
Oh, okay. Well, and so – you know, so – again, I was reading your very sarcastic, very critical Facebook feed through the convention, and like you were clearly critical of just about everything that happened. I think, you know, maybe after Paul Ryan's speech, you said something positive about Paul Ryan. And,
yeah, Ryan, McConnell, and Cruz are the three high points of this, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And the Cruz, because you agreed with everything that he said, or you just liked the fact that he was thumbing his nose at Trump?
I didn't necessarily agree with everything you said, but I agreed with most of it. And yeah, again, that it's one of those things where it's hard to know. Do you give him credit for sticking to his principles? Like he's decided that, you know, I'm not going to support this guy because he's unfit to be president and because he accused my dad of assassinating Kennedy and called my wife ugly, all of which I think are perfectly reasonable reasons not to endorse someone. Mm-hmm. Or is it just because he is the type of person that, you know, the more people tell him to do something, the more powerful he becomes in his resistance. Is it just that he's kind of a punk and that's why he was refusing to do it?
Chris Christie's response, so they interviewed him on CNN right after that speech. And it was so hilarious because he was basically like, after sort of saying he just broke his word, I can't believe that, you know, he broke this promise. And then he basically said, this is why everyone hates Ted Cruz, because he's such a weasel, basically. And all Ted Cruz cares about is himself and what's going to be good for him, and which I thought was just hilarious and was basically, you know, this is why everybody hates Ted Cruz, basically.
Which is probably a fair assessment.
Totally.
I don't know anyone who, I mean, I suppose his wife, I assume, likes him.
You know, I've met lots of enthusiastic Ted Cruz supporters, but I think it's probably the case that 98% of all Republican politicians hate him.
Well, and even enthusiastic Ted Cruz supporters, it's not because they like him personally. It's they like his policies.
I know people who like him personally.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, there are some Westmont students who are extremely enthusiastic about him.
Fair enough.
But so, I mean, the point that I was chasing to is like, so you were super critical. And then to me, like the interesting thing, as was I, but then to me, the interesting thing is sort of like, the extent to which we're super critical of that whole act of political theater for the same reasons. And so like to me, I mean, there's this huge debate about whether the Trump nomination is the death of the Republican Party. And like, to me, it's just like this is the Republic. This is the logical conclusion of the direction that the Republican Party is going since the 1960s, right? And so, like, this is just what you could have predicted would have happened in the 1960s, right? And so it's really true that the Republican Party is the party of Lincoln. The Republican Party is the party that was established to stop slavery, right? And that's really true of the Republican Party. If I lived in late 19th century America or early 20th century America, maybe, you know, all the way up to the 1950s America, I would have been a Republican, right? But then in the 60s, that all changed, basically. And like the Democratic Party was the party, up until that point, was the party of unreconstructed racists. And then in the 60s, it switched. And the reasons for its switching are complicated, but Goldwater ran. Goldwater was against all of the civil rights legislation. Goldwater, I think, was a good dude in this regard, and he personally wasn't a racist. But for matters of libertarian principle, he was against that. And then lost decisively. But like from that moment, and then Nixon started to run, and Nixon's Southern strategy was all about reaching out and was very explicit about reaching out to disaffected white Southern voters who were against segregation. And then that was it, right? And the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party did this because there were lots of really decent people in the Democratic Party, but also because there are probably a lot of political operatives who just saw the political calculus going that way and said, look, we're going to be a party whose electoral success is going to depend upon African-American votes. You know, sort of highly educated, upper-class white people and African-Americans. And so ever since then, the Republican Party, it's been the politics of the Southern strategy. And that sort of consistently repeated itself from Goldwater to Nixon to Reagan to both Bushes all the way up to the present. And it's just gotten more and more intense. And so like all of that like manifests itself in the politics of Donald Trump. Sorry. So that's a little bit of preaching. You have thoughts on that?
That's certainly a good articulation of kind of the leftist view of the Republican Party. So
good. Yeah. So let's disagree about that.
Yeah. So obviously there's some of that that's true. And you can't deny that Nixon particularly went after the Southern racists, even as he was signing civil rights legislation. So, I mean, Nixon is an interesting guy sort of across the board. But there's some of that that's going on, but that's not actually the major kind of theme of the convention. So minor themes at the convention, sort of the sub threads that were running through the whole thing, military, money, and morality, right? Our military is in the tank. Our economy is in the tank, and our morals are all just terrible. We need to put those all back on the right track. That includes things like rebuilding the military, supporting the police, restoring morality, especially sort of pro-life politics, strengthening the economy, working to stop illegal immigration. All of these sort of lined up with an anti-establishment and anti-politician attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that leads into kind of the major theme of the convention, which is Donald Trump. This was a 4-week celebration of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. a four-day celebration of Donald Trump.
It just felt like 4 weeks for you.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And I'm sure he would have loved it to have been a four-week celebration. But over and over and over, we were told by almost everyone, excepting Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, and Ted Cruz, that Trump is a conservative, moral Republican. And because everyone keeps saying it, well, then it must be true. Mm-hmm. Yes, there is that demonization of the other side, and some of that went on. But on the positive side, it was all about Donald Trump. And I mean, really, you saw that. We've already mentioned Trump was there every night. That is a breach with tradition. You don't usually see the candidate until the last night. We saw him all four nights. He was on stage all four nights. One of them was piped in by video. He was in another city, and he was still on stage at the Republican convention. There was a Trump on stage every night as well. So it was Melania, and then Don was Tuesday, and Eric was Wednesday, and then Ivanka and Donald were Thursday. So every night there was a Trump. Someone with the Trump name was on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, the theme was, this is all about him. It ties directly into his speech. He is the one who is going to do all of this stuff. So you say it's the direction the Republican Party is heading, and again, that's at least partially true because the Republican Party has picked this guy. But it's also the case that really the things he's saying are not inherently Republican. They're just kind of all over the place. Donald Trump's great strength is his ability to sort of know what whoever he's talking to wants to hear and then say it. So, you know, if I think I've also said this on social media, if he were to walk into this room right now, he would probably know how to get my vote. Like he would be able to say, hey, these three things that you care about very much, I'm totally in favor of those. And this is what I'm going to do. And then I would just have to remind myself after he left, wait, this guy just does that all the time. He goes into the next room. And if whoever's in there thinks something completely the opposite, he'll just say that. So the only consistent thing that we know he's in favor of is himself. And that came out at this convention. I mean, that was the theme of the convention, is Donald Trump is what it's all about. Which shows if you read the Republican platform. So the big kind of unspoken tension here, even apart from the never Trumpers, who were there, and we can talk about that if you want to. But the big unspoken tension of this convention is the platform, what it says versus what the candidate says. So the party platform, that's the statement of beliefs, the statement of policy positions of the party. It is very sort of traditionally conservative, very free market, very kind of traditional marriage, very sort of pro-immigration in a moderate sense, but pro-immigration in that sense, pro-jobs, pro-business, so on.
Pro-life.
Pro-life, of course. Donald Trump is none of those things. So there is a disconnect between the party institution, the party apparatus, and the people who voted on the platform, including the people who voted, the delegates who voted for Donald Trump, and what Trump himself is doing. So I don't know how that's going to work itself out. I don't know what that's going to mean in practice. Nobody actually reads the platform, other than the people who it most directly affects. But the people who it most directly affects are the people who organize campaigns do the various things that are necessary to win elections. So we're going to have to wait and see what that looks like. From my perspective, the big theme is Donald Trump, which is just awful, I think. But what can you do? Mm-hmm. I did not vote for the gentleman in the primary. Not that it mattered at the end. Yeah. I wish I'd voted for Bernie. He almost won Missouri, and I could have been a part of that almost victory.
What was I going to say? You know, so I don't disagree with anything that you said. Like, I think that's exactly right. I guess I would just say that, you know, the reason why he won, right? So it obviously wasn't because of his conservative bona fides, right? It was because he ran on the Southern strategy. And you're right. So like, he has perfected the Southern strategy. I mean, there's also a level of alienation and disenchantment that he's able to capitalize.
Yeah.
But he's like taking that, like, so he run, so like the Southern strategy has been employed since the 60s successfully. And that card has played important roles in, I almost want to say every Republican campaign since then. There was Reagan's Welfare Queens. What else? There's that horrible business with John McCain, where there were those nasty whispers during the South Carolina primary that he had fathered a brown-skinned illegitimate child. I guess that was sort of linked to the W campaign, but there are the first Bush's Willie Horton ads and the campaign against Barack Obama and like all of that stuff. And it's gotten to the point where like playing that card has become such an important part of electoral success. That sort of like, so that's why he won, right? He won by playing.
Oh, and I would disagree with that. So I would go back to our Trump episode, and I'd say the reason he is winning, that is part of it. But what he's tapping into is not this weird latent racism that, again, the left likes to see there. He's tapping into anger. There are certainly people on the right who are angry for racial reasons, but that's a part of it. That's not all of it. He did not win.
So I'm not saying that every Donald Trump supporter. So I want to be careful. I'm not saying that they're all racists, right? But I think they are all really exercised by the fact that the world is changing around them in ways that are making them very uncomfortable. And a lot of that has to do with these people who look different. I mean, I think like that's a big, it's not like they're racists, but,
yeah,
I mean, it's interesting.
I would say it's much less about race and much more about the idea that the people in charge don't actually know or care what I think.
Yeah. Well, so again, I mean, it's, an important part of the rhetoric was, right, the immigrants, the Muslims. It wasn't just these, these politicians in Washington, these Republican and Democrats both, they're knuckleheads and they don't care about you. I care about you. It wasn't just that. He wouldn't have won if it was just that. It was, I'm going to build a wall. These Mexicans are rapists. We're going to keep the Muslims out. Like that, like without that rhetoric, the rhetoric is the secret sauce. And so, like, the Southern strategy is the reason why he won, and I think sort of gradually all of the principled reasons have sort of faded into the background. So, and that was, like, the first point. And then, so this is, I have an interesting question for you. So, like, on the, so you like the platform.
Again, I have not read the whole thing, so I can't fully endorse that. But
the platform was more or less a traditional Republican platform.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the platform from 4 years ago with a few updated things here and there.
And then, so here's a kind of a prediction or like the way that I see Trump. Like, he's not an ideological – I don't mean that in the pejorative sense. He's not a conservative. Like, and I don't think – he's not a conservative, but – I think he cares about – I don't think he disagrees with any of the issues in the plank. I just think that he doesn't particularly care about them. So, I mean, do you think he is – so let's say that he's elected. You know, do you think that he's going to enact pro-life policies and appoint pro-life judges?
I think there is no way for me to know.
Uh-huh.
So I think, again, if he is talking to conservatives, then he would say, yeah, he agrees with the platform and so on. If he's talking to Democrats or to liberals, he's going to say, no, I don't agree with that. And I didn't have a hand in writing that. And I would never do that.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's any way to know until he actually picks someone.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly don't know. I just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So I get that. To me, and again, it's like, it's not like I think he's really invested in those issues in the way that, say, you are. But I don't think he disagrees with the elements of the platform, right? So he's not invested in them in the way that you are, but I don't think he disagrees with them. And I'd be shocked if he didn't appoint justices, say, that you weren't perfectly happy with. And I totally understand your skepticism about that, but I just think that he's sort of more or less bought into this mode. I think he's probably vaguely pro-life. He doesn't really care about them. So I think he basically agrees with all the elements in the platform, but he doesn't really care about them. And the only thing that he cares about is, I think he genuinely cares about immigration. I think he genuinely cares about free trade. And I think he generally cares about the economic fallout of all of that and thinks he can do something about it. That's sort of like my take on things, but I understand your skepticism about
it. Yeah. I mean, he says he cares about all of those things. He has not said or at least he has not stuck to saying he's pro-life. So I wouldn't guess on that. I would say that if he does become president and if he nominates a pro-life judge, it will probably be because some senator gave him the name. Like, again, because he is so all over the place, depending on where he is and depending on who he's speaking to, you can't say what he thinks other than it's all about him.
It's I think that's undoubtedly true. And I think the fact of the matter is, I mean, has he wavered very much on sort of statements of conservative principle? I mean, since he announced his presidency?
Oh, yeah.
So I know you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So he's, again, and the things that he hasn't wavered on, his campaign has. So even the wall, like even the wall with Mexico, that the campaign, he keeps using the rhetoric of it. But if you look at some of the campaign follow up, it's always, well, there may not be an actual wall.
It's going to be more like a white picket fence, you know,
right,
and maybe some daffodils planted in front of it, that kind of a thing.
So again, it's just, there's no way to tell.
I think he's more or less going to govern in the way that, like, I think he doesn't care about, I don't think he personally cares. I mean, one thing is just like, he hasn't thought about it. I suppose that, like, he doesn't particularly care much about issues of LGBTQ issues. And that was one instance in which he sort of wavered about whether he was in support of the North Carolina law or wasn't in support of it. But I think once, you know, and so, you know, he was asked about that and he just sort of answers on gut intuition and he just hasn't thought about it very much.
Right.
And it doesn't particularly exercise him. And I think, but once he's actually in, if he wins the election, I think he's more or less picked a side and, you know, there's just, yeah.
Unless he decides he's on the other side.
Yeah, but I just don't like, I don't think he cares about that stuff.
I mean, if he decides, he'll look better if he rules more from the left.
But he won't. Right? He's made his bed with, he's chosen these people. He was a Democrat in the 90s. You know, he probably could have run as a Democratic candidate in the 90s.
Sure.
I think his political views have probably changed, and he's exercised about different issues that land him on the Republican side of the divide now. And he's now made his bed with the Republican Party. I would be shocked if he didn't more or less govern more or less as a conservative.
You will be shocked if Donald Trump does not keep his word as president.
Oh, no, I didn't say that necessarily. But he's not going to do what the Obama administration has done in response to LGBTQ issues. That's just not going to happen. And he's just not going to appoint a pro-life judge. He's just not going to do that. You know, he's going to try to build a wall and he's not going to be able to do it. But it's not because he doesn't believe in it. It's just because that's impossible to do.
Right.
And he's not going to be able to screen Muslim immigrants, not because he doesn't believe in it or doesn't want to do it, but because he'll discover that what he wants to do is impossible. So yeah, I mean, he's going to break campaign problems, but not because he's a liar, but because he runs up into reality.
Well, right, but I mean, that's sort of the nature of every president, right? I mean, that's every president promises us everything and then gets into office and finds out, oh, it's not actually real world possible.
Well, yeah, but you know, but there's a difference. Like, most politicians don't do everything because it's not politically possible, right? In Donald Trump's case, it's like physically impossible.
Well, I mean, it's both, right? I mean, the worst decisions presidents make are often the ones where they've made these huge campaign promises and by God, they're going to stick to them no matter what. So, I mean, that's how we end up with, you know, No Child Left Behind or Obamacare or any of the other train wrecks.
Yeah. H.W. Bush and I'm not going to raise taxes.
Right.
I mean, you know, so like he broke that campaign promise, but for political reasons, not for like physics reasons.
Right.
The reasons we're not going to build a wall is it's not the same kind of – it's not just a political – it's not that he can't – it's just because you can't do that.
Right.
I'm sure that walls will be built, but it's not going to be a wall that spans our border with Mexico. And you can be darn sure that the Mexican government is going to pay for it. That's just not going to happen. He's going to try to renegotiate trade deals, but he's not going to be able to because it's just not going to happen. Because it's impossible,
right,
to happen.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it requires the country we have the deal with to collapse to get that changed, or you know, us to go to war with them. I mean, that's really the only.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. Right, and yeah. So, anyways.
Yeah. Well, anything else from the convention proper? Otherwise, we're running a little long here.
No, why don't we wrap things up?
Yeah, I just two additions if we have a minute. Sort of big lessons from this. So what are the takeaways? Other than the stuff we've been saying about Trump, which we've probably hit that enough. As you pointed out, I think in some ways this convention is a sign of where the right has mostly gone in America. kind of an abandonment of everything but kind of the thinnest facade of traditional morality and values. Mm-hmm. So that is certainly one thing that we see there. I don't think that's necessarily what the delegates intended to show, but that's probably mm-hmm. what people saw on TV. Still, with that said, I think it's worth highlighting that there's some kind of good substructure in place, right? There's a basic decency and lawfulness. Even with the open carry rule in place, there were no shootings, there was no rioting, there was no upswing in violence in Cleveland. Even the Never Trumpers, when they tried their mini uprising, did not break out into violence on the floor of the hall, right? Mm-hmm. If you were following the news after that first day, they were talking about, you know, chaos on the floor of the convention. I was watching it. It was not chaos. Like, there mm-hmm. were some people shouting, there were some other people shouting, and then they voted. I mean, it was mm-hmm. about as orderly a disagreement as you can have mm-hmm. at a party convention. So LeBron James leaving Cleveland for Miami caused more social unrest back in 2010 than mm-hmm. the Republican convention did. I mean, mm-hmm. there were actually riots then. So this has been a pretty tame event across the board.
So if the anti-Trump party had succeeded in not nominating him, I mean, I was never worried about violence breaking out because the people opposed Trump. I was worried about violence breaking out because of Trump supporters. And so if they had succeeded in getting the rules changes that they wanted, then I think...
Yeah, I don't know. I still think there would not have been violence in the hall because most of the delegates there were not Trump folks. Visitors and outside the hall, I don't know. I don't know mm-hmm. what was going on outside because there was nothing going on, so it wasn't really covered in the media. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. Also, if you didn't watch, and if the listeners didn't watch, be sure to follow Colbert after the convention because The Late Show was fantastic. It made up for the hours and hours of Republican convention politics that I had to watch last week. Hopefully it'll make up for the hours of Democrat convention politics that I'll have to watch this coming week.
Was he focusing on the convention a lot? I saw his little stunt. Oh, he was.
So the Monday through Thursday, he was live after the convention. It was almost...
Cleveland?
No, he was in New York.
Okay. So, I saw his little stunt on the first day, which I thought was hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think he was back and forth. They're obviously not that far apart. But it was worth watching. I hope he is even-handed. He of course... made fun of the Republicans because that's what late night talk show hosts do. But his guests were all Democrats or liberals or majority Democrats or liberals. So mm-hmm. I'm hoping he does the same thing next week, except with in reverse. I don't mm-hmm. know if he will or not. I don't know what his personal politics are. I don't know what the politics of the station are, but hopefully we'll see something there. So there's your free infomercial for Colbert.
He's a very serious Roman Catholic.
He is.
But I think a political progressive, but I think sort of moderate. He's a good dude.
Yes.
Anyways. Okay. Well, with all of that said, we will reconvene next week and repeat this exercise after the Democratic convention. The City of Man podcast is a proud member of the Christian Humanist Radio Network family. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. You can find the webpage for all of the podcasts in that family at christianhumanist.org. You can visit us, and we love likes and comments on our Facebook page. That's just facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. Or equally, you can leave us we really appreciate a review on iTunes. We have several reviews now, which are really exciting. Most of them are chiming in on our intro music. Leave us a great review. Chime in on the ongoing debate about whether you like our theme music or not. But it's a great way to help other people find the show. And I will close by saying, as always, render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.